All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Creative Genius Podcast. We have another rousing evening of plenty of awesome topics to get into, but first, let's talk a little bit about Stranger Things 2. Adam, have you started?
Have I started? Yes. Have I finished? Yes. All of the yes.
Well, I think that's excellent. I started it, and I watched the first half of the first episode, but I haven't been able to go much further just because of life being busy and stuff, but from what I've seen so far, I'm super excited to get more into it.
All right, well, then we can't talk about any of it until you finish watching, because I don't care about spoiling it for other people, but I won't spoil it for you.
Oh, well, that's very sweet of you. I appreciate that.
Mainly is because I just want to talk to someone about it, and I know I can't talk to Lou about it, so...
Lou, you've got to get on some of this popular stuff, man. I'm telling you, you're missing out.
Yeah, man. I've heard of Stranger Things. Don't get me wrong. I actually heard about it on a podcast, but I don't even know what network it's on. Like, or in terms of like, I think it's streaming. So don't get me wrong that way. Like, I've got that down, but I can't tell you if it's on Hulu, Netflix. What are the other ones? I don't know. There's a bunch of them, but yeah, I can't tell you which one's on. So that tells you how much I don't know.
This is also Stranger Things 2. So you missed out on Stranger Things 1.
Yeah, no, I remember when Stranger Things 1 came out, because I that's when I heard about it, actually. Surprisingly, I had heard about it when it was a 1.
But no interest in watching?
No, I did catch a 60 Minutes interview with the creators, or the, like, writers, I guess you could say. I think they were, like, these brothers. They were, it was a pretty cool review, and like, of them and like their life and how all like E.T. and all this stuff when they were like growing up, like, kind of influenced them to write what they're writing today. So I thought that was kind of cool, but no, I still don't have very much interest in watching it. Sorry.
Have you seen E.T.?
Yes, kind of. I mean, I was forced to watch it as a child and I don't really remember it.
I have no words.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's not your thing. No worries. So I'm curious to know what this mining cryptocurrency for ads thing is. I'm not sure who dropped this in the notes here, but if someone wants to elaborate, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, Lou, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely talk about this a little bit. I didn't explicitly read this link, but I think I have an idea of what's going on. I think, Adam, you probably dropped this in here, though. But as I understand it, there is the ability now to essentially kind of, instead of having ads put on your sites as you're going around the web, you can essentially use either JavaScript to basically allow your computer to mine for cryptocurrencies. And in the end, if the site is lucky enough and they actually, you know, solve the complex, you know, block, it's a block, I'm pretty sure, Adam, you can clarify for me, then they get paid, you know. And I think the prize for that is like 1 Bitcoin, which, I don't know, at current value, that's like something like $7,000 or something. So they can actually make a lot of money. So it's sort of lucrative for both the user and the site itself, and it seems in a lot of ways that it seems actually kind of pretty safe. It doesn't really seem like there's any real risk to the user. But Adam, do you have any more to add to that?
Yeah, so the link that I included, and my bad for completely butchering the URL in the Pages document, so oops. But we talked about this a while back with our advertising, right? Where, yes, it's a way for the site to make money. It's not a way for users to make money because they're just using idle cores of their CPU, which in turn would actually cost them money because that would draw more electricity and their electric bill would go up. But what we found is, we mentioned that there was a site doing this, which was the Pirate Bay, where they basically piloted this program where instead of ads, they put this JavaScript, the script that would use idle cores of your CPU, basically max out your computer when it was on that page, so to mine this currency, which would make them money. So that was going on, and there was a lot of kind of talk around that. And now it's been identified that 2,500 other sites are doing that, and even Android apps with tons and tons of downloads on the Google Play Store. are using just idle parts of the computer when that app is running, or when that app is in the background, or in the case of when you're on the website, to basically mine this currency. So in a way, it's kind of a sneaky thing, because you wonder why your fans go on high when you visit a website, or you wonder why your battery is draining really fast when you open a certain app, and come to find out that this app, in place of ad revenue, is now just using your device to just churn through this currency to try to make them, you know, pennies on the dollar across millions of transactions. So I wouldn't say it's great for the user. Definitely great for these companies, you know, who have been doing this, but it just feels like an overall shady thing. And it's just, you're seeing more and more instances of it since we first talked about it a couple episodes back.
Yeah, I think there is some, you know, ways that you can augment that. I was listening to, I think it was a Security Now episode recently, where they were talking about this. And the one thing that they were bringing up in that episode, at least, was that the user should still have the option to pick of whether they would like ads, or if they would just, you know, like to say sort of like an extension is, or something like that, where you like a trust prompt, or, you know, something like that, where they could say, cool, don't show me ads on the site ever again. And that would at least put it back in the user's court, which I think would be cool.
Yeah, I think as long as they're popping consent, great. But most of these ones are kind of doing it in the background without any form of user consent, which is odd.
Yeah, definitely.
So to get around this, yeah, just block all scripting. So block JavaScript, which breaks a lot of sites. But if you're ever curious, or you wonder why your fans are going on high, just pull up your activity monitor and then see what's using it. And if it's a website doing it, then try to figure out why that is. And just don't visit that website anymore.
That's definitely some useful information, yeah.
Unless you want to, you know, support that cause, then by all means, leave that website running. But if it's something that you're like, hey, this smells fishy, like, I don't remember doing this, then there's some things to check.
Very awesome. So it looks like we've gotten our podcast on TuneIn and Google Play. So far we've gotten on quite a few platforms. If there's any that we're missing, we definitely want to hear about it. So if you use an app more regularly than the others, please let us know so that we can definitely get going on that. Do you two know of any regular using podcast applications or places where we might be able to end up?
So right now we're on some of the biggest platforms, right, with Apple Podcasts and Google Play, as well as TuneIn. I know Spotify is something that Lou is trying to get us into. And the other one that we're kind of abstaining from at the moment is Stitcher, mainly because of their agreement with how they process podcasts and kind of the way that they deal with advertising. But if there's a big market of Stitcher users out there that really want to listen to the podcast, like, there's definitely ways to get it. And like, if you have feedback and you say, hey, you guys really should be on Stitcher because XYZ, like, just send that in and we'll reconsider. But I remember when we looked at it, it was something that we had talked about staying away from, but we're in a lot of other platforms and our website has the RSS feed if you want to pull straight from there. So get it wherever you can.
If you listen regularly, you'll know exactly how we feel about advertising.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep doing work and keep spreading it more and more, hopefully, so that way it's anywhere you'd like to find us. I mean, there is, Adam will just infinitely spam me with more directories to get into. So, and I do my best to try to get into as many of them as we can.
Excellent. So we'll be keeping our eyes out for different places, and we'll keep looking at Stitcher. And if there's enough people that want us to be on there, I'm sure we can make it work in some fashion. So a little bit of follow-up. Mosh Posh, did I add something to the Urban Dictionary? I haven't officially gone into Urban Dictionary to add my definition of Mosh Posh, but it's definitely a gymism so far, so maybe I can make that a more popular turn of phrase.
I just hope that you keep using it, and then we definitely need to get it in Urban Dictionary. And then don't be afraid of using it. Like, I'm sure you're still going to, right? But anytime you drop Mosh Posh, we'll just have to throw that link to your Urban Dictionary definition.
T-shirts, maybe? Mosh Posh?
Ooh.
I don't know.
I mean, okay, so use it in a sentence, because we've only heard really one sentence of the Mosh Posh. So let's come up with like a good slogan. Like,
Yeah, we're gonna need to think about that as a slogan, and t-shirts might be a thing. I think you might need like a bell or something, like ATP does for APFS.
Remember what I said? You can't just take stuff from other podcasts, Lou. Like, I'm gonna ban you taking stuff from other podcasts.
Hey man, you gotta augment somehow. I mean,
well, that's not augmenting.
T-shirts are from other podcasts.
T-shirts are from everything. Everyone makes t-shirts. No one rings a bell when someone says a certain word unless it's taboo or ATP when you're talking about a podcast. And you specifically call them out by name.
Yeah, man. Got to give them credit where it's due. But, and Adam, come on, t-shirts? I wear white t-shirts. You should know this. I get my white t-shirts from you.
Yeah, I know. What was the last time you ordered like 30 of them or something like that? And...
yes, your poor wife had to like bring me like 30 shirts. It was great.
Are you still rocking the white t-shirt, like casual dad not being a dad look?
No, I primarily wear a black t-shirt now, but I have, of the white t-shirt collection I bought from you, I would say I have probably 7 or 8 left, which is pretty good. And I don't wear them like every day. It's a lot more, you know how white t-shirts get. They're older, they've been washed a bunch. They shrunk a little bit. Like, they're more like undershirts now. So I need to definitely refresh.
Well, don't go through me, because I don't think we have that account anymore.
Damn.
So Costco, Kirkland, Signature.
Kirkland Signature.
That's their brand.
I haven't been, so I wouldn't know.
Oh man, Kirkland Signature is the best. You get Kirkland Signature vodka, you get Kirkland Signature shoes, you get Kirkland Signature underwear. Kirkland Signature, what else? Tons of stuff. But it's just the Costco brand, you know, where they'll relabel stuff and sell it under their brand at a discount.
So they buy Fruit of the Loom, put Costco's brand on it, which I think is Kirkland, and say it's Kirkland.
They do that?
Yeah.
Dude, I knew they did that with the vodka. As I heard, at least, the vodka is like Grey Goose vodka, but it's literally just like distilled and like put down a different line, and then like just, you know, slapped a Kirkland logo on it and off it goes. But I mean, I didn't know they did that like so much with like everything else too. That's crazy.
Yep. Costco is a behemoth, and they're all over the place. I love it.
Nice.
So going back to, I think it was last episode, maybe that was the robots one or the one before that, not sure. But sometime in the past, the not so distant past, we were talking about user interfaces, and it sounds like there's kind of a movement going on with how developers are changing that UI. So when we originally were coming up with user interfaces, it was based off of what you can actually use in the physical world. So like your desktop was based off of literally your desktop. You know, you have, you know, your music and your maps and your books all on your desktop, and those are all easily accessed on your user interface on your computer. You know, the trash bin is literally where you put your garbage from your computer. And so kind of a more modern movement is to get rid of that ideology and to move into something maybe a little bit more fluid in terms of workflow. So Adam, have you experienced any sort of more modern UI that you like and any that you dislike? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think it's funny because you absolutely called it out, where when we talked about UI, we didn't even really talk about how UI was modeled or where the inspiration for UI came from. And you put it very well that everything in UI is modeled after something in the world, some physical object that we used to use, like your desktop, like you said, was your desktop. And the file folder, right, is an actual folder, and you deal with things in folders and files still, and it's very much how we organize and how we categorize everything. And you can see that a lot of companies have tried to do this, Apple namely being one of them with iOS, where with iOS there was never really a way to see the file structure. There was never a way to like drill in and like, I just want to make a folder here and throw a bunch of pages documents in it, and that's it. Right? It was very much the app that you opened contained all of the documents that you had. And then when the cloud service came around, it's like, okay, now all those documents are in the cloud. So yes, you open the app on whatever device you're on, and all of the documents that support that app are listed, and you can open them, work on them, edit them. But as we move to where files are no longer necessarily stored directly on your device, they're stored in the cloud, there has to be a better way to find and be able to navigate and find your files, work on your files in as easy of a way that it was with this physical implementation of it, or this physical kind of manifestation. I can't think of a great word or term for it, but I think the Files app on iOS is the newest thing that's come out, and is kind of as close as you can get to a Dropbox type thing, where you can create folders, you can see everything that you have, you can still open everything, but I still don't know if that's the future or if that's just kind of a stopgap because people are still so ingrained in these old ways and we have so many things that still relate back to this old UI. So to answer your question, I haven't seen anything that I'm blown away by, but I think that there are still a lot of potential for something.
I think some good user interfaces that are coming out, and it's also another topic that we talked about, is how we interact with drones. It's very much like a video game, and a video game is very, unlike, how we interact with really any other technology. Now we have like augmented reality with it and stuff like that, which I know is kind of getting into kind of a little bit of off topic, but I do see user interfaces going into augmented reality, and we're already seeing that, with video games and drone technology, and military uses it a lot. So that's kind of where I see that going. Do you have any thoughts on that, Lou?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's more familiar to people in terms of UI. I just think that, at least right now, from the drone perspective, I know I'm the one that owns the drone on the podcast, and drone UI is still tough, especially on small screens. It's pretty cramped, to say the least. It does a lot better on something like an iPad when you fly with an iPad, because you just need that real estate, because it's really complex. But I think it's, if you've ever played a video game, it's exactly like playing a video game in a lot of ways. Or even further, if you want to blur those lines, if you've ever done like a flight simulator, it's like spot on like that.
I think you're onto something there. So let's get right into. Oh, just kidding. We have one more thing here. So just some feedback from the fan base. Last week's episode went on pretty long, longer than it normally is. Not that any of us feel like it's too long, but that may be too long. We don't know. So really, what we don't want to know is what kind of length of time are you looking for from your podcast? Are you looking for an hour? Are you looking for 2 hours? What is that golden spot, if you will, of time with our podcasts? Would you guys say that's pretty fair?
I think this was a question Adam threw there. I don't know. I think this is funny though. This is last week's was a little long for us in terms of our norm, we seem to be going for that like hour and a half to 2 hours, and it creeped above that 2 hour mark a little bit. So I think we were just kind of posing a question to the fans to say, hey, are we going a little longer than we should have? Did we drag on a little too much? What do you guys what are your thoughts? So that we'll kind of pose that and. Find us on social media or on the website and give us some feedback.
Yeah, I put that in there because I know last time I kind of looked down and I was like, oh, dang, like we've been recording forever. Maybe we should stop. And it kind of brings us to something where we all listen to various podcasts and there's not a one-size-fits-all solution to anything. But in terms of, quote-unquote, fan service, right, was it too long for you? Do you want it shorter? Do you want it longer? Because we can do that too. But yeah, just once again, being open to feedback, starting this thing, finding our groove, and just let us know.
Awesome. So let's jump right into it. So this week's episode is about space colonization, which I'm personally really excited for. When I first started going to college, not really first, kind of as I kind of got into it, I thought I really wanted to be an astrophysicist, but it turns out the math is really hard, so I stopped. because math is really difficult for Jimmy. But, you know, we have a lot of different things that we can talk about in this particular area. So, you know, just to kind of kick things off, where do you guys think this is going to happen?
So when you say where, are we talking, where are we going to go? Are we talking where are we going to be living? I guess that's my question is, because when I think of space colonization, I think of the human race trying to find different places to live. And since we know space is so incredibly vast, we know that would take a while. So a lot of portions of life are spent on a spacecraft, let's say, unless we find some magic way to travel faster than we've ever known. Or what planets that we end up inhabiting. And we can look in the 50 term, you know, 50 years into the future, we can look 500 years into the future, we can look 500,000 years into the future, try to see like where we think things are going to go. But I'm curious what time frame or what limitations you want to give it.
Well, I mean, honestly, I really think we're already technically colonizing space. We have the International Space Station, which several different people from several different nations are living in and consistently get supplies to. And obviously nations around the world have different ideas of how they either want to live or weaponize or, you know, have military enforcement in space and stuff like that. So, and we have all sorts of, you know, we have a litter of satellites and stuff. So I think, you know, if space is already colonized by robots that we've made, right? And to some degree, we are colonizing the orbit of our little blue dot. So I think in some sense, we are already kind of colonizing space, but it's not in any means, I think, sustainable at the moment. So, I mean, I guess really what I'm talking about is a sustainable way of space colonization. Does that make sense?
As a where?
Yeah. So like where would be like a good first pick? So like, are we talking living in giant space shuttles or where we have little communities, or do we want to go to a planet?
I honestly think that finding a place to inhabit is going to be the first step, right? Finding the destination of where we need to go. And like you said, right now we kind of have feelers out there and robots kind of going out and doing the scouting for us. But once we find that place, depending on how close or how far it is, how far away it is, I think we're going to have to, like you said, have a community on this spacecraft. I think that is going to be, for the foreseeable future, where we start our space colonization journey, is on these giant spacecrafts kind of living there and having lives and having children and kind of going through different generations almost as we go on this giant journey or this grand journey to the next planet that we're going to inhabit. I definitely think that's going to be, like I said, for the foreseeable future, where most of the time is spent. And once we find that planet, great, then we start that whole process. But I see us living on giant spaceships for a while before we get to the next phase.
So basically, we're going to be like WALL-E, those people from WALL-E.
I mean, WALL-E, you got to hand it to Disney, right? And Pixar when they bring out these movies, because that kind of told you a lot, especially when we talk about climate change, which we'll get into, and all the trash and people being big, fat, lazy slobs with screens in front of their faces the entire time. I mean, go Disney. And yeah, I think that's what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
Maybe not really fat, you know, but
I don't know. I mean, I think we definitely, for the foreseeable future, will be probably on some sort of craft. And I did mention, I think in the outline at some point, that, you know, I think the moon might be a place that's not that hard to colonize. I mean, granted, it's nowhere near the size of Earth, so it's not going to support a major amount of life. But if we're just growing that, that's probably, you know, not a thing that's too hard. And, you know, I mean, journey wise, it's only a couple days to get there. So it's lucrative in a lot of ways. I understand gravity-wise, there's lots of problems to solve that way in space. But I think for right now, you know, that's an easy one. I did mention Lagrange points, which I don't know how much you guys are aware of those, but these are really, really fascinating points in space where, you know, essentially you're rotating at the same rate as Earth. So a year is a year at that point in time, or that point in space is the same as an Earth year. So it's not that different for us. So those, I think, might not be bad places. And I guess the other place that comes to mind is geostationary orbit, so that we get the same feel of rotation of Earth itself. They all have upsides, they all have downsides, but those are just a couple things that came to mind. Sorry if the Lagrange point's a little crazy. That's a kind of a technical term. Adam and Jim, I think you both know my degree is kind of space-related.
I actually was learning about points in my calculus class. And from what I understood, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lou, because you're the expert on this one, but I thought it was like this point in space where two massive objects, where their gravity is equal, and there's just kind of this suspension place where, you know, if you were to put some object there, it would kind of appear like it's floating just because there's equal amount of pull of gravity on either side. You know, a good example of this would be like how Jupiter orbits the sun, because all of our planets, they kind of orbit kind of near the center of our sun, and that's where their Lagrange point is. But with Jupiter, it's actually on the surface of the sun just because of how massive it is. But if you have two massive objects, or just two objects of similar mass, their Lagrange point is going to be kind of in the middle of their orbit somewhere.
Yeah, that's a fairly good summary of it. There's different sort of reasons. At least with Earth, I could be 100% wrong here, but I'm pretty sure there's five or six Lagrange points. I don't know if there's one behind us, but I know there's essentially, they refer to them as like L1, L2, L3. They're all just like numbered. And I know 3 and 4 are the ones that we've considered pretty like inhabitable in that way, because they're not very far from us. I mean, I forget which one is completely opposite us, but it's like, you know, way out there and would take significant amount of time to get there. But I think 3 and 4 are the ones like that are essentially, if you think about us on our rotation around the sun, they're you know, out in front and out behind us a little bit, and so they're lucrative. They're not that bad to get to, but rotation wise, as I understand it, those are just going to help with, you know, keeping us in that same rotation of the Earth, so we're not kind of out of sync that way. And I think we have to consider that a lot when we go to space, because I mean we are very whether we want to believe it or not, we're cyclical creatures. You know, we work on a cycle, and so there's a lot that's going to throw us off when we go to space.
Yeah. So real time follow up. There are 5 points for Earth, and the biggest problem right now is cosmic rays, because you're not protected by the atmosphere.
Just remember that everything in space, including Earth, is trying to kill you.
Yeah, man, that's the best way to live.
Yeah, just always in survival mode.
Like, you get to the end of the day, you're like, ah, nothing killed me today. It was a good day.
I put kind of a cool thing in the show notes. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at it. Like, I literally just put it in there because we had something in there talking about communities. And if you're really sick of Earth and super tired of all the bullshit that's happening here, I definitely get it. You can totally become a citizen of Asgardia, which is actually a real thing that you can do. And they're a space community in which you can be a citizen of. And it's actually kind of interesting. I don't know a whole lot about it. It's something that I kind of read about in passing. Apparently, there's about 113,000 citizens so far. Have you guys heard of this, or do you know anything about it?
I personally haven't.
No, I'm kind of looking at it right now. I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah, this is a real thing.
Yeah, I haven't heard of this.
112,000 people.
Yep.
They want me to enable cookies to improve their website user experience. Okay.
So easy to win Adam over.
Well, it came from a trusted source. Come on. Yeah, this is kind of crazy how already people are kind of changing their, or have the desire to change their citizenship to a citizen of the, of not Earth, but somewhere else.
The Space Kingdom.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard of it, but that's I don't know. My first take is like that's a little bit of a head scratcher. I don't know how I feel about that one.
Here's an interesting fact. Asgardia is the 175th most populated colony that exists, just behind some countries that I cannot pronounce. But the Bahamas is actually not far away. It's 165th with 392,000 people. So that just kind of gives you an idea of how big that actually is. So it's pretty interesting. So people are actually really taking that seriously.
Looking to the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the future really is space colonization, I mean, you know, there are going to be different colonies, and I guess this first one is kind of getting a head start on that.
Get in now.
Yeah.
Buy your real estate on the moon now before prices go up.
So we have something else here, kind of an interesting idea, kind of more on the theoretical side, way down in the distant future, but, you know, colonizing outside of our solar system. And our solar system is massive. So, you know, we have the sun, which is at the center, and then you move out and you kind of get out to the Kuiper Belt, which is where...
Wait, Earth isn't the center of the solar system? When did this change?
Copernicus called, and it turns out you're not the center of the universe, Adam. So I don't know what to tell you, man.
Man, my mind has blown.
Wait a minute. Can I get out my Flat Earth Society card real quick?
Yeah, right? Flat Earther.
So you get out to Pluto and its moon Chiron, which is kind of the Kuiper Belt, which is where New Horizons recently just passed. And then you go for a really long amount of time and you reach this place called the Oort Cloud, which is kind of the extending reaches of our solar system. And just to kind of give you an idea of how big this place is. So there, the two closest bodies that exist in this Oort Cloud, as they call it, is about the same distance from Earth and Saturn. And I don't remember the exact mileage of the distance between Earth and Mars, but we did have a spacecraft that was traveling 65,000 kilometers per hour to get there, and it took it, 3 years to get there? So Saturn is even further out than Mars by a crazy amount, so it's a long ways away. And so that would be the very outer reach of our solar system. And then to even think about getting to the next solar system, our neighboring star like Sirius or Betelgeuse or so forth, if they had something that was habitable, or had anything that we could even set our foot on, it would be really difficult to actually get there. But I think it's a really interesting sentiment, and I think it's really interesting to think about. So outside of our solar system, what do you two think?
Well, that's kind of what I had mentioned, like, right at the beginning, right, is I think for us to move off of the planet, we have to have a place to stay, and we can artificially make our own place to stay, or we can find a place to stay. And if we happen to find a place to stay first, that's where we'll go. And that may take a very, very, very long time to get there, especially if it's outside of our solar system. But I think that both options are actively being explored. And I'm sure there's tons of different simulations that people have run and lots of research that people are doing into each area. But I mean, I'm just done with our solar system. Like, I want to get out of here. I want to see something new, you know, like, I don't care if it takes me, you know, 1,000 years to get there. Like, I want to do it.
Well, we do have a satellite called Kepler that looks at different planets and stuff, which is pretty cool. And they can study the climate of these different planets based off of, spectral rays, which kind of tell you the, makeup of the different molecules and, different things that are in that particular atmosphere, which is pretty interesting. So we actually are kind of doing that in a way, kind of looking at it with a cool telescope. But it'd be really cool to actually send something, to your point, Adam, to actually send something somewhere and like have a human-made object or human themselves on a different planet in a completely different solar system. Like, I think that'd be pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the sort of thing of, you know, colonization outside of our solar system is, you know, hard for my individual mind to even fathom a time scale when that'll happen. But
hey, take something from another podcast on an infinite time scale.
You know, I mean, it is something that I think, you know, maybe 100 or a couple hundred years we could be talking about that. But I think, you know, in the next 100 years, we've got our challenges just to get off our own planet in a timely manner. And it's totally doable. But I think that sort of long-term travel, you know, really starts to create some massive problems for us as humans. So we'll see. I think a couple hundred years is at the very earliest the time scale I'd put on that. And I think it'd be cool if we can get there.
Absolutely. I think it'd be really cool. So which kind of gets us into kind of our next idea. So, you know, we talked kind of a little bit about where kind of our ideas of, you know, where it would start, kind of where maybe it'll finish one day in a couple hundred years, but kind of talking in terms of when. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about what we can do kind of in the short term future. So, you know, about how long do you guys think we'll actually be able to do something reasonable, like, you know, go to Mars or go to the moon and colonize it, or, you know, do some exploring in our own cosmic backyard?
I mean, I know I just kind of answered the long term thing, but basically the in the short term, you know, the moon or, you know, Lagrange points or Mars, as we've been talking about, I think, you know, at least the moon is, I think, doable within, you know, 10 years. I mean, we could start to get that out of the way pretty quickly. I think we had to. We've been to the moon before. We could probably do it again. It's a matter of figuring out the colonization side of the equation. As you start to talk about some of the, you know, further out points, Lagrange points and Mars, I think 50 to 100 years is probably the right time scale.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that boat too. I'd say 10 to 15 years before we start really seriously having those discussions and having options available for people to even consider that or sign up for that, things of that nature. And then about 50 years, we'll definitely be on another planet close by, whether that's a moon or whether that is Mars. I think those are the two in the closest, you know, future. So I'd say 50 years. I'm kind of on Lou's side on that one.
So 50 years for the moon and for Mars?
I say 10 to 15 for moon and then 50 for Mars.
Lou, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely doable. 50 might be a little quick for Mars, but I mean, we'll figure it out. I think 50 to 100, like I said, max 100 years from now, I think we could easily be on Mars.
Don't say I never agreed with you, Lou.
This is true. I mean, I was kind of taken aback when you said I agree with Lou on this. I mean, that tastes like vinegar coming out of your mouth.
Man, I don't discriminate. You're all horrible people to me. I'm just kidding. Just Lou.
So I think 10 to 15 years for the moon is certainly something reasonable if governments took it seriously, like if they were like, okay, we need to get the plan to make this happen. And I think 10 to 15 years would really be like a reasonable amount of time. In terms of Mars, SpaceX and NASA are estimating mid-2030s to have a manned mission there. And I kind of posed a question if this seems optimistic, and I think it'd be fair to say that you two think that 2030s is optimistic, considering we, you know, kind of in the 50 year range.
If we know anything about Tesla and their estimates and guidelines for release dates, we know to pad those numbers a lot.
Right. Exactly. And I think I'm kind of in the same boat as you guys. You know, with NASA, as much as I love the government organization and what they do and how much technology they've offered to us, it's kind of a bleeding organization, unfortunately. Like it's really not doing well. I really am not optimistic for NASA's long-standing kind of place in our government anymore, just because it just doesn't get the funding that I think it deserves. And I think, I don't know, I just don't see it lasting very much longer. So I really think if we are going to get to Mars, I don't think it's going to be NASA. I think it's going to be privatized companies like SpaceX. But I think personally, they're really optimistic to think mid-2030s is going to be the time, especially for a government organization, because you're sending people there. And if the government wants to get anything done, it takes forever anyway. And like you two are saying with Tesla, those dates are wishy-washy at best. So I think 50 to 100 years, really, I think is going to be the time frame for human beings to actually get to Mars and have a reasonable plan in place to get shit done. To, you know, to have people there, have it be sustainable, and make it work.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a testament to what we talk about too, because we talked about robots last time and how the military was a great, you know, kind of breeding ground for robot technology. And we've talked about that. It's a recurring theme where the government's great for getting things bootstrapped and getting a lot of good minds together and a lot of money thrown at something, you know, to kind of start that fire. As I like to say with Lou, like, they like to throw a bunch of money at something to get the interest going and get the technology going. And after a while, it gets to the point now where the privatized companies can start kind of taking those reins and taking over from there. And like you said, it's really disappointing to see funding for NASA go away, because that organization has such a great history, you know, in terms of like the U.S. history and what they've done and how they've opened, you know, everyone's eyes to kind of just the wonders of space, and made a lot of really, really great milestones for us as a human race. But I think with privatized companies, like, if there's a way to make money on it, that's, hey, you know, people are gonna try to do it. But now I think is a good kind of time where we're seeing that transfer from government funded to privatized. And I think, like you mentioned, Jim, that's definitely going to be where the future is, especially when we're talking about colonizing nearby planets.
I mean, I think all the technology is there. I think it's certainly doable. I think it's really expensive, and I think it's really hard to do. And I don't think anybody, at least in the United States administration, is super motivated to do it right now. I mean, with all the things that's going on in the world, I feel like this is not high on the priority list, trying to get people to Mars. And so, like I say, I mean, there's just so many reasons why I don't think 2030s is happening, especially for NASA. Do you have any thoughts on that, Lou?
Yeah, I mean, I think with everything that's going on in the world, like you said, Jim, it's not high on the priority list. And I can see why it kind of gets lost in the, you know, day-to-day mundaneness of just, like, we've got to run a country. And so funding this, you know, side project, at least for right now, is a hobby. And we would love to do it, but, you know, it's not, like, a critical need, like, I don't know, national security or something like that. So I understand from that perspective, but you know, I think that SpaceX is oftentimes a little aggressive with their timelines, to say the least. And Tesla always was too. This seems to be a thing of, you know, Elon Musk's agenda is to, like, overpromise something, and oftentimes he does not deliver on time. But I think a lot when he started, you know, even SpaceX or Tesla, I think a lot of people counted him out and, like, said he wouldn't even be there by, you know, 2030 building an electric car. And, like, here he is today. He's there. So I think our estimates of saying, like, 50 years from now may not be that far off, because, you know, he's essentially saying he'll be, you know, we're talking about 15 years from now, he'll be on Mars, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him somehow manage to make it there in 30 or 35 years and still beat our 50-year estimate. He could do that. I wouldn't put him past that.
Sometimes you need, like, a crazy visionary to jumpstart and kind of light a fire under other people's butts to get them motivated. And that's what I see Elon Musk doing a lot, is he'll put something very aggressive out there. It's like, hey, we're going to replace everything by this date, and, you know, we're going to take care of this and this and this. And people are like, whoa, yeah, right. And then when he does finally deliver, whenever that is, even if it's past the promised time, he's still delivered, right? And that gets people thinking like, oh man, like even if he's not serious or even if he throws out something that's completely bonkers, like we should probably have some people on the side looking at something similar or the same type of work just to cover our butts to make sure, right? So he's really good at almost intimidating other people into competing in different spaces and, you know, kind of venturing out of their comfort zones for the benefit of humankind.
So why even go in the first place?
Because we done fucked up the nature.
Amen to that, man. We screwed it up. What can we say?
Yeah, and that's verbatim from the show notes too. Is like, why? Because we done fucked up the nature. Like, what more of an explanation do you need? Like, we've squandered the planet that we're on right now, and that's it. You know, we see that in a bunch of different ways. Like, talk about, you know, climate change, global warming, right? Which is attributed in a large part to humanity and how we've used this planet that we've lived on. And we talked about this in our nature episode too. It's like we've never really had a symbiotic relationship. We've been more leeching off this off the planet and never really giving back. So that's why, you know, we have to even think about leaving home, is because it's overpopulated, we're not taking care of it, and we now are like a virus spreading out to the rest. And like, pull quotes from numerous movies where they make that analogy, but that's in truth why I think we have to leave.
I think in terms of overpopulation, and this is kind of off topic, and I apologize for that, but it's kind of funny. I think we've kind of moved into, you know, humans especially, we've kind of moved into like a modified version of Darwinism, where we don't choose our mates or the people that we want to have children with based off of, do you have nice birthing hips, or how tall are you? Are you strong? Can you survive in the winter? Will my kids have good genes? Like, that's not what we base off of, you know, who we want to have kids with now. Like, we base off of, how do you make me feel? Are you going to be stable in the next 10 years? Are we going to be stable in the next 10 years? Are our kids going to get along? Do we have the same goals? And so it's kind of funny how we've effectively removed ourselves from natural selection in that sense. And it's kind of had this runaway population effect where we make enough resources for about 10 billion people to live on the planet at once. And we're at about 7.5 billion people. And that number is only climbing because people are living longer and having more babies. And that problem isn't going away. So that's definitely an issue as to why we need to kind of get moving on this whole, we need to go figure out another place to live. Do you guys think that's fair, or do you think that's ridiculous and I'm off my rocker?
No, that's totally fair.
Yeah, I mean, I see this from a very math perspective, you know, and so population's climbing and resources are essentially going down because there's more and more and more of us. So at some point, those two, you know, lines cross and we've got a problem.
I mean, we're already starting to see that, right? I mean, it wasn't so long ago that Venezuela was having kind of a panic attack where people couldn't get fresh water anywhere because it wasn't available. So the government was kind of having a panic attack about that. I don't know if you guys heard about that. And then where the Jordan River is, that area, all their fresh water is gone. So they now have to filter the salt water out of there and use that to get their water now. And so, I mean, we're already seeing these resources dwindling. I mean, it's not like all of the water on Earth we've consumed and it doesn't exist anymore. The water still exists. All of the water that has ever been on Earth is still here. It's just in forms in which we can't use it now. And so those resources are, like you said, Lou, dwindling.
Yeah, and we mentioned this, you know, in other episodes as well, as like trying to renew what we can and find different ways to reuse what we have or to repurpose something. And we haven't been doing a very good job of that. And it's catching up with us now, right? And like Lou mentioned, like Jim mentioned, there's going to be a point where we can't sustain life on this planet anymore. And we need to move beyond that. Because there's only so much matter, there's only so much materials we have to work with, and once we've exhausted all our options, there's really no other, there's no other plan, you know, like that's the option we have.
Yeah, so I think we're, I think you're kind of getting to that point where it's important to start thinking about our resources. And, you know, furthermore, other species won't be able to survive here either. That was kind of an interesting point that someone dropped in the show notes here. I mean, look at how human-centric I am. I've just been thinking about, you know, me and my humanity. I didn't even think about the other inhabitants of the Earth of like, oh, we're ruining it, but then it's bad for everything else too. So, so when we do decide to go leave to Mars, are we going to take any sort of animals with us? Are we going to have a Noah's Ark situation going on here? Take two of each animal on our spaceship?
A giant sex boat.
A giant sex boat.
It'll be like the 70s.
you can't take that. I mean, that's from John Oliver. But when you talk about, yeah, Noah's Ark, right? Like a bunch of animals, two by two, different sexes, getting on a boat together. And you know the reason they were there. They're only there for one reason. Get busy. I do think we'll take animals in forms of livestock, right? Just because that's how we know to sustain ourselves, right? We know we can grow crops and we know we have animals. And I think first round, right, we'll go there and we'll try to start growing things, see what we can get. And then second round, you know, they'll start bringing animals to take with them to eat the vegetation and provide compost and all sorts of great stuff, right? So I think eventually some animals will come with us, but there's a bunch of different ramifications for that too, right? Especially when we talk about taking plant species off of the planet and taking them to a different environment. And now you talk about really just expanding kind of nature's whole shebang they got going on there, right? Where you take nature in the form that we know and you transplant it somewhere else. And that to me already gets my mind like kind of running in circles, because I'm like, wow, okay, well, then we is that truly, you know, what we should be doing? Because I guess, you know, seeds or plants, you know, like they were just designed to spread their seeds as far as they could, and as long as we keep enabling them, you know, they can keep doing that.
So Lou, I wouldn't expect you to know this next point here, but Rocket Man, we all need a plan B. So spoiler alert, Rocket Man is a, I guess, a family comedy, sci-fi, kind of all wrapped up into one.
This is really funny. So I actually put this in the notes, you're totally taking it a different direction than what I meant, but that's okay.
Well, go ahead and lead it out then.
I think I know what he's referring to, and I think he's poking at, I'm assuming, nuclear war, right?
Yes, I am totally. As some of you may know, we live in the U.S. and our president finds it fun to belittle those who have nuclear bombs. So, you know, that seems, you know, wise. So my point here was, well, nuclear war is totally a thing and we all need a plan B. So being off this earth wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea.
Yeah, I said nuclear. I meant to say nuclear.
Yeah, I got what you meant.
Yeah, I know. But it just reminds me of Family Guy. Did you say nuclear? Did you say nuclear? It's nuclear, dummy. The S is silent. Were you talking about like the old Rocket Man like Disney thing that they had?
That's what I was talking about. Apparently, we were talking about Trump.
No, well, yeah, how Trump on Twitter calls out the leader of North Korea as Rocket Man. You know?
Yeah. That connection just happened as Lou was talking about it.
It's so sad, right? Like,
I was thinking about like, Disney and this guy's dreams coming true, and then. Nope, it's about Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, well, no, we're talking about nuclear fallout and the plan B. Oh, great.
Whoops.
The fact that we even have to think about that is just ridiculous.
Oh, well, they thought about it in the 60s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? Or was that... No, that was the 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's gotten brought up before, but...
I mean, it definitely got brought up with Japan.
I mean, if the world ends because of a 280 character tweet.
Thanks, Donald.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned 280 because, guys, yeah, Twitter upped its character limit.
Yeah,
I know.
No longer 140. It's officially that 280. So now he can say Rocket Man like 8 times.
Someone in that building needs to go take his phone away and never give it back to him. Like, he has lost phone privileges.
So I remember seeing all sorts of articles from, you know, like unspoken or not unspoken, but unnamed aides in the office in the White House where they say they have to like hide the phone or they have to just keep Fox on a loop, you know, in his office. Cause if they play CNN and they say something bad about Trump, he gets angry. And then once he gets angry, he gets unfocused and all sorts of stuff. Like when he first became president and it was coming out and it's just like, yeah, man, like that guy is glued to his phone and he's now on his, you know, Asia trip where Twitter is banned in China, you know, like they don't allow you to have China, but yet, hey, at, you know, 5 a.m. or whatever, he's still tweeting. So it's like, all right, man. So you're already now circumventing the host country's firewall and their, you know, kind of customs and rules. So you can still get out your 280 characters. Like, come on, man. Like, grow up.
He is obnoxious.
All right. Yeah, let's not turn this into a Trump rant.
Yeah, he needs restrictions. That's all he needs.
Yeah, someone needs to enable the parental controls on his phone.
Should be like, yeah, no internet after these hours, and these no apps can be installed from the App Store. And
he's only limited to opening these apps. Only apps 4 and above. Oh. Limited to PBS Kids and...
This could quickly turn into an Xbox rant 2.0 just about our commander-in-chief, but...
We're a little passionate about it. Sorry for everybody who didn't want to listen to another political podcast.
Oopsie poodles. I mean, it's a part of our culture, right? I mean, it's tech and culture. Anyway, so who's going to get us there? So we've talked about SpaceX. We've talked about NASA. They definitely have something in the works in terms of getting us to wherever we want to go as far as recolonization of another planet. But there's two other places where it might be coming from, which I dropped in the show notes. The Planetary Society was founded by Carl Sagan, which is now run by Bill Nye. And so he's a really big advocate for getting us to Mars as well. I don't know if they actually have their own plan of making their own thing. I really doubt it because they don't make near the funding that even NASA makes, I don't think. So I don't think the Planetary Society is going to get us there before anybody else. I think really the folks who have the best chance of getting us there the quickest, if they decide to put their minds to it just because they have the money, is the U.S. military.
Hey, man, throw that military funding at it. It keeps getting bumped up every time, you know, there's a Republican president.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the military is probably the closest just because they for all intents and purposes, basically have a blank check, it seems. But I'm definitely not counting SpaceX out because Elon's a scrappy fighter and he seems to budget quite well. So most of his things, they go over budget a little bit, but they're not that far off from his crazy ideas, it seems.
So I think one thing to point out with the military is we're very reactionary to in terms of where we throw our resources, especially with the military. So in thinking of a sci-fi type mentality, is there would have to be some threat, you know, some immediate threat for us to immediately have the military drive colonization or, you know, space exploration into their department spending, right? Like we'd have to have some alien threat and say like we need to set up a moon base that's got, you know, crazy amounts of, you know, firepower just to make sure that we're good. And we should probably set up stations on Mars as well, you know, so we can also get that stuff going just to protect ourselves, right? Self-preservation, you mentioned, Jim, is ingrained in our DNA. So I think that for the military to throw a bunch of funding at space colonization, there would have to be some immediate threat for them to want to do so. Because otherwise, they're perfectly happy, you know, sitting there with their checks and collecting, you know, money and spending it on other resources that that are affecting us right now or threatening us right now. So,
kind of makes me think of that movie Arrival.
Yeah, that's a good movie too.
Oh, phenomenal movie! I loved it a lot. I loved it a lot.
Yeah, so it, and that's exactly right. You know, so in that movie, right, you have a foreign entity, which, you know, seemingly came from space, aliens, show up on Earth, and boom, what's the immediate thing that happens? Tons of military surrounds it, tons of military funding to get all these people and all these resources in the same place to, and that's their first gut instinct. They're like, what does it want? Why is it here? Like, is it going to hurt us? You know, what's going to happen? So, man, that's a good movie. I haven't watched that movie in a while, too. Like, I need to watch that movie again.
I love that movie. It was so well done.
So I watched it in the theater with a coworker, and we watched it, and I think it was like an 8 o'clock showing. So, you know, movie gets out at, what, like 10:30, something like that. And, like, the end of that movie was just so, the twist for that movie, you just kind of sitting there, and I was thinking about it, and we were just silent walking out of the theater together. Like, we didn't have anything to say. Like, we were just still thinking and stewing on the movie, right? We're just like, man, that movie messed with me.
It made perfect sense, though.
Exactly. That's why, like, you were trying to think, like, you come out of a movie usually, like, thinking, oh, such a movie-type ending, you know? Like, all right, yeah, whatever, you know, movie ending. You wait for the, you know, the end, you know, like, all right, there's a climax, and then here's a resolution, conflict resolution, we're good, you know, and it's always some, you know, stupid thing, or like, oh, we unplugged this, or we stopped this portal, you know, from being open again, every superhero movie ever. And yeah, coming out of that one, it tied it up so well and kind of answered all the questions that you would have had that you just really didn't have anything to say. You're just like, wow, good job.
It's one of those rare times where you have really good closure from a movie. And I feel like whenever I get done seeing a movie, it's like, oh, the sequel will be great. And then the sequel never comes because whoever decided to write or to direct it decided, oh, well, that was the ending. It's the later the tiger situation. You decide what happens. It's like, no. Give me a story from start to finish and close it off and be done. But anyway, with this movie, I think what it did best was, and what I think it did even better than Interstellar, in my opinion, is it really addressed the idea of space-time just being this thing that just exists, just a thing, a plane, an existence in which you travel through, just like going from point A to point B is the same thing on the time scale. It always is. We just don't perceive it that way because we don't live forever. But she had this revelation of, well, here's my whole life. It's right there. I see the whole thing. And it just, her life always was, it always is, and it always will be. I think they just did such a great job of making that understandable, and it was so subtle. I really loved it. And if you haven't seen the movie, you got to go see it, or else you'll have no idea what I'm talking about. But I think it was, I thought it was really good.
Yeah, you and I just totally jumped into this before asking, Lou, did you even see that movie?
No, you're good. Yeah, I didn't see it at all. So,
oh.
I've just been sitting back.
Lou, you might actually really like this movie. It's really not like your classic, you know, Hollywood blockbuster or whatever. Like it blows my mind. I don't know how else to put it. It's just really well done. I loved it.
So, Jim, I think this is going to have to be a project for you and I. I think we're going to have to come up with, Lou, you're going to have to give us a number, but it will be like 5 or 10 movies that you have to watch before the end of the year. Maybe not the end of this year. Maybe this is a project, you know, for New Year's resolution 2018 stuff. But give us a number of movies that you are willing to watch, and Jim and I will have to like compile a list of movies that you have to watch that you have not seen next year sometime.
All right, I will give you a non-zero number of at least. I'm going to say I'll commit right now 12. That's one a month next year, so that I have to get through. You guys can name any 12 movies, and I will commit to watching them.
So, okay, since this list is probably shorter for you to send us, is like just write down the movies you've seen, so we know not to choose those.
Oh, you don't have to worry about that. There's so few that you won't pick them. Don't worry. Just start writing them down. I guarantee you the 12 of you pick, I will have seen none of them.
All right, Jim, you and I can start a side channel in Slack or something where we can just list a bunch of movies, and then we'll have to compile that into a top 12 list for next year. Totally sidetracking the conversation, but I think that would be, we would finally get you into pop culture, you know? So like, instead of the 12 steps, it's the 12 movies you have to see.
And if any of our listeners have any ideas of what movies Lou should watch, please send those suggestions our way.
Yeah, tweet at us, not at Lou, or DM us, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah, if you DM me or tweet at me, I'm just going to forward it to Adam and Jim and just say, hey, here's one they say I should watch. I don't know what this is.
Yeah, is this a movie title or is this a feedback on something that I did wrong?
Yeah, I will. It'll be interesting. I'm actually kind of excited for this because I don't know if I'm gonna like really enjoy this or I'm just gonna like watch and be like, oh, okay, that was cool. But we'll see.
All right. Well, that's homework for us.
We'll get some good movies together. So we talked about, you know, where we want to colonize, when we're gonna do it, why we're going to do it, because we fucked everything up, and who might be doing it, to which we think, you know, probably the military would probably be the most likely if there's some kind of impending threat, right? So with any sort of big adventure, there's a litter of problems to solve. And just to kind of get us percolating, there's some kind of immediate things that seem to have come to our minds was terms of energy, protection, materials, food, water. You know, something that I thought of was atrophy from having less gravity on your body. And so, you know, our bodies are designed to exist on Earth, and, you know, we exist with 1G of gravity, which is less than that on Mars. So you experience less than 1G of gravity on Mars than we do on Earth. So, your muscles would atrophy, and probably a lot of other things would as well. And I don't know how much that would actually affect your body, especially your fluids, because the fluids in your body are mostly regulated by how much pressure is acting on us at all times. So what are your guys' thoughts? You know, what do you think are going to be some major problems that we're going to have to kind of work through as far as colonizing space and planets and stuff?
I think you definitely brought up a lot of them, and we mentioned this in the robot episodes. Like, why would you want to model anything after humans? Like, we're really not that great of a specimen, right? We're at the top of our food chain, but in terms of our adaptability and survivability, and Jim, you kind of mentioned this too, right? Like, we don't really consider that a problem because we don't have that threat. Like, we're not as concerned about that. And I think in terms of our bodies are designed and fit to live on the planet that we're on. And as soon as we take ourselves out of that equation, I think the way it's going to affect us is going to be one of the bigger challenges. But with the studies they've done in space, it turns out, you know, like, okay, well, we have ways we can work around that via artificial gravity, whatever it's going to be. But keeping ourselves alive is going to be the hardest part. And that means, yeah, having food, water, and making sure all of our insides still work. So those, you kind of named them, those are the top issues.
Yeah, I'm really curious in terms of, we're going to obviously, I think, I put in this section a little further down, EVA, you know, basically, I assume we're going to have to walk outside at some point. We're not going to be just trapped in a craft forever. And so I really, from Jim's, you know, remark about our insides and what's going to happen that way, I'm kind of curious, you know, what suits will look like, because I assume we're going to have to be in them. And so does that look something like what a fighter pilot wears, where I know, like, they wear those, like, compression suits so that it pushes the blood back towards our heart and, you know, back towards our brain so that we're not, you know, having problems that way. So there's a lot of issues that way. And, you know, EVA is super complex in space. There's, you know, oxygen regulation and all sorts of stuff like that that's got to happen every time you walk out of you know, a craft or something like that onto some surface, and that's complex. And are you roped and all sorts of things? So I'm kind of curious what your guys' thoughts are. Do you see us like all walking around outside, or do we just like build inside everywhere?
I think for the time being, we're going to be not necessarily outside without the lack of like a suit or anything like that. It will be what I envision is when you see the typical like space colonization, right? You see like these pods, like these big glass domes almost, where you have the feeling of being outside without actually being outside. And you kind of have all the benefits of creating your own atmosphere inside this, you know, artificial space without the going super stir crazy, as long as the dome is big enough. But that makes me think of the movie Biodome with Pauly Shore, which was a horrible movie, but they kind of go crazy after, you know, a certain amount of time going stir crazy in these places. But I think creating little bubbles is how we're going to go about this, especially when we're talking about like the planets that we foresee us inhabiting in the near future. If we find something that is comparable to, let's say, something like Earth, something like where we live now, I can totally see us just going out and roaming. But in the meantime, the little space bubble is what I think of.
Well, those space bubbles are actually really, really awesome. There's a lot of homes that are designed after that shape. And it's because, one, they're super efficient at refracting light inside of the dome, just because of the way that the panels are shaped. And so you don't actually have to have a whole lot of lights in your house. You can have like maybe really like a couple of windows that lets natural light in, and it bounces off really well. So you have a lot of natural lighting that goes around very easily. And it also does a really good job of regulating temperature as well. So those shapes are actually super efficient. And that's why they're always modeled that way on, you know, those photographs, those CGI photographs that we see of colonizing planets.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be one thing we have to worry about. The other thing is, and we started mentioning this when we talk about having to travel like really far distances, is the potential psychological problems, right? Just being in a confined space with a bunch of other people for so long. And there's lots of things that people have to try and solve this, like cryosleep, things like that. But one thing I put in here, which kind of relates back to what we talked about a couple episodes back, is like virtual reality, right? Where almost an escape from what you're doing. Or wouldn't it be great if you could, you know, just strap on a headset, very much like we talk about in Ready Player One, you know, which has been a theme that's been brought up by multiple people different times, to kind of escape the reality that you're in to cope with what's going on. So I think that's an interesting potential use case. And Jim, I think you also have some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, so there's, it's a little bit off, I guess, a little, now that I'm thinking about the actual movie, but Ender's Game. Ender's Game, really the actual underlying problem was this, spoiler alert, by the way, there happens to be this kind of prodigy in terms of his ability to, I don't know how to put it, war games. He's really good at how would you guys put it? He's really good at strategizing. There we go. He's really good at strategizing, especially in terms.
He's really good at command and conquer.
Yes, he's really good at chess. Right, like he's really. Yeah. He can take out his enemy very well. And so he deals with some really bad psychological effects from that. I feel like that would be really similar to what other people would kind of experience. It's like they're leaving their whole species behind to go start something new somewhere else. And I would imagine that would be really traumatizing. And I think virtual reality could be really helpful with that and kind of soothe, you know, that transition to where, you know, if you can somehow interact with people back at home through virtual reality, I think that would be a really cool way to kind of mesh that pain and make it less substantial. I think that was a really cool point that was brought up.
Yeah, you might want to consider adding that movie to my list.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a better book than it is a movie, but
yeah, we'll get your list going. Don't worry. Just remember, these are all the things that you could be actually watching. And the list is supposed to like jumpstart you into going out and finding these other things on your own. Or the list will be like, man, you guys sent me 12, and then next year maybe we'll do 50. You know, like, who knows, right?
My brain is still just returning error.
So another thing I put of like problems that we'll probably have to solve, especially once we start going further out, is, or I think I didn't put this in there, but I put the movie that, that I thought this related to was Asteroids, right? Lou, did you drop this one in there or was it Jim?
I dropped that one in there. Asteroids is kind of a problem. I mean, you think about it, space is... Well, I mean, like, I think one thing to consider, too, is we think of asteroids as huge things, but, like, space dust is, like, literally a problem. You can't exactly be, like, you know, just walking around the surface of the moon, and then all of a sudden you get even hit with, like, something that we on Earth would call, like, a grain of sand. But that grain of sand could be moving, like, thousands of miles an hour, and if it hits you, man, you are done for.
A really big problem that the International Space Station deals with is a lot of space trash from satellites that either collide or are decommissioned. A lot of times, little metal shards will hit the International Space Station, and in some cases, it actually cracks the glass. And so they have to make those repairs and stuff. It's actually quite a big deal.
Yeah, so that reminds me of another movie, Gravity. Did you guys see Gravity?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. George Clooney. Poor George Clooney.
Poor George.
Poor George. And then the other one I put in here, which kind of deals with a couple different things that, that we've talked about already, is Passengers, which with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt, where they're on a large colonization mission on this ship that's basically piloted for the next, I think, 90 years to another Earth-like planet that they're going to colonize. And one of the passengers wakes up early because the ship on its journey gets hit by a massive onslaught of asteroids and actually damages the hull, so it causes a couple systems to malfunction. And he wakes up and has to deal with basically being the only one awake, so going kind of stir crazy. He wakes another person up, and they in turn have to try to get along with each other. And they're both there for different reasons. They both come from different backgrounds. So talk about asteroids getting hit. You also talk about just the cost, right? Because he basically got a free ticket for kind of going to, he was an engineer. So he had a useful trade that they were going to use when he colonized or went to work on the new planet, which they called Homestead. And she, who he woke up, she paid for her own ticket because she had tons of money. So you talk about, you know, psychological aspects, asteroids hitting, and then the cost, right? It's not going to be cheap, especially when you talk about the first voyage to another planet. That ain't going to be cheap. Like, you're not going to talk about like a Southwest, you know, fare from here to San Diego for me being, you know, $150 round trip. It's not going to be like that. You're getting a one-way ticket to a new destination that is going to cost you your entire life savings, I assume.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious cost-wise. I mean, we did, that is definitely in this section of the outline. What your guys' thoughts, even remotely, I mean, cost-wise, are going to be. I mean, I have some thoughts that about costs, and I know right now per pound to send to space is just ridiculous. I mean, it's insane to think how much it is even to send just a pound to, say, like somewhere like the International Space Station, which is in LEO. So that is, you know, if you really start to think about that, and we even account for the fact that costs are going to come down, I can't even begin to fathom what, you know, sending one human to the moon would be. I mean, I'm expecting hundreds of thousands of dollars, even if we're doing it at mass scale.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say $500,000 easy.
I think it'd be more. I was just recently reading a study based off of how much it costs to keep a soldier like in Afghanistan or whatever, how to keep them like living for a year with all their gear, food, you know, just to sustain them, right? And it for one soldier, it costs $1 million for one year.
For a year?
For a year. $1 million per year per soldier. And so that's on Earth, right? And it doesn't cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to send a, you know, per pound of food or whatever to some place on Earth. It doesn't. So I think if we're talking in terms of sustainability and keeping, you know, colonizing and all that, it's, I mean, I can't even fathom how much it would be just to sustain the human, right?
Well, yeah. So, and when I think of cost, I think of the cost of the ticket, right? Because I think that's honestly what you're paying for. And then when you get to wherever you're going, you're going to be working not for money for you, but money to fund the expedition in a sense, right? You talk about working for the company store. It's like, that's essentially what you're signing up for, because that's the only way to fund that type of journey and the colonization itself is like, hey, you pay this large upfront cost for the ticket, for the even basically just to get you from A to B. And then after B, you know, you're now working for whoever got you there or whoever runs that other place. And they're going to have some different form. And like, this is something we haven't even talked about either, is like, now we're talking about different societies, and we kind of touched on it when we looked at the Asgardia, right? Is now you're talking about different currencies, different cultures, different everything. And I think the upfront cost is unfathomable to us when we think about the long term, right? It's like, yeah, if we think of what does it cost to sustain a human and now living this brand new life, like what's that going to cost? Because that's a question we've never really had to answer for ourselves, right? Like, we've always worked and we've paid for our way and we keep ourselves fed, we keep ourselves housed. But now we're talking about doing that in a totally different environment. But I think cost for me boils down to just the cost to get you there. And then after that, that's a different beast, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, so cost to get one person like to the moon is much different from getting one person to get to Mars.
Yeah. Right?
So I put my $500,000, like, yeah, just to get someone up to, you know, like the moon for a vacation for 2 days or something like that, you know, like,
yeah,
whatever. But yeah, buying a one-way ticket to another planet, I mean, when we talk about like the top 10%, let's just say the top 10% of the richest people could afford it. And that's a lot of money, you know. I think of like the Yelp review for, you know, Southwest or, you know, whatever the SpaceX flight line gets called. I see their Yelp review being like, you know, the dollar signs, and they have like a range from like 0 to 5.
Yeah.
It's like theirs is like 8.
I can totally see like, oh yeah, but we've got financing, 0% interest. Don't worry, you can go.
You probably won't even get free peanuts on that flight.
Probably not.
You probably don't even get any meals, right? Meals are all extra.
Probably.
Oh, think about carry-on bags.
Oh, God.
What did you refer to it as? A business essential or economy essential or something like that?
Basic economy.
Basic economy.
Yeah, basic economy. It's totally a thing. Like, you go to like American Airlines right now, or even like United, or all the big ones, they have this thing called basic economy. It's like, yeah, you can bring you. Yeah. And if you live in the Northeast and you have a coat, you might have to pay extra. No, I'm joking about that. But like, it's really sad. It's like, you literally can't bring like anything with you. And it's got to go like under your seat. You can't even use the overhead bin. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, man. So basic economy on a flight to the moon or to Mars.
Yeah, I have to say, a prime example of basic economy is, they just call it economy, but I have flown a long haul flight on Air France from LA to Paris direct. And I have flown it in two different classes. So I have seen what business class looks like, and I've seen just what economy looks like on that flight. And on the exact same flight. So in business, it's 6 wide on this giant like plane. So there's 2 on one window, 2 on another window, and 2 in the middle. And in economy, it's 11 wide.
Ooh, boy.
That is crazy to me.
Pack them in like sardines.
Yeah. Ugh.
So who put this link in there for the cost? Because like, this link is from 2012, and they're saying $100 billion for 6 astronauts to get to Mars. And that's in 2012.
I put that in there. I'm sorry.
No. I'm glad, because I'm actually reading through it, but I'm just like,
oh,
I'm like, wow. Like, yeah, we start talking numbers, right? And that's $100 billion for 6 astronauts, right? And that's, I'm assuming, just the cost, you know, like, we're not talking markup. We're not talking profit margin. We're talking the cost, like bare bones. What does it cost to get someone there? So now you talk about, you know, the retail price of a ticket.
Whoops, it's really expensive.
Whoops, no one can afford it. Well, whoops. Certain people can.
the top 10% of the top 1% in the United States.
Yeah. In the United States. Let's just move that out to the world.
Jeez.
Lots of princes, you know, with tons and tons of wealth will be able to afford it.
I mean, you're right. A lot of the wealth is just, it's crazy. Anyway, it's a whole other thing that I can get into.
Man, we segue so much into like, and I love how we ran ourselves back in. It's like, wow, we could talk about this for around like 20 minutes. Like, we probably shouldn't do that right now though.
It's just a lot of angry. That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's a lot of anger.
A lot of rage.
It's a lot of rage.
I feel like we often have to play this game of like whack-a-mole where it's like a check and balance of like, no. Whack that one back down in there. Come on. We're going to keep on moving on. Not doing this now.
It's like breathe, count to 10. 1, 2, 3. I can't do it.
Start your meditation again. It's okay.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I need some mindfulness in my life.
Not when we talk about Xbox, that's for sure.
Hey, no one mentioned it. You were the first one to mention it.
Because I'm always thinking about it.
You're a victim of your own demise, right?
It really is a problem. So another problem that I kind of thought of was kind of bacteria and viruses that we could take along with us to these uninhabited worlds. Or if these worlds are inhabited by bacteria and viruses and we don't know it. So, I mean, even if we did take medicine with us, would they even be effective against these microbial life that would wreak havoc on our DNA? I feel like that would be a really big problem that we would have to consider.
Yeah, right. And especially when you talk about maybe even going outside, like Lou mentioned, right? It's like, I just want to go outside. It's like, no. We have no idea what's out there. Like, you don't want to go outside, you know? And that reminds me of another movie, Andromeda Strain, which, if you haven't read the book, is a great book. Where an asteroid lands in this small town in New Mexico and basically kills all but two inhabitants of that town, a baby and an old man. And it's basically when this happens, the military scrambles everyone to this top secret facility to analyze this rock that fell from space, or this, I think it was a satellite actually that had gone on a mission and collected a sample and brought back, but why and what it was that was killing all these people. And just the fascinating thing of like how, and this book was written a long time ago, and they had a movie that came out, I believe in the 80s, I want to say, based off the book, where they're just trying to identify what this organism is, because all we know is what we've encountered, right? And we still find some things and some organisms that are pretty freaking amazing in terms of their resiliency to just different environments and the way that they interact with their environment, the way they've adapted. And we talk about now expanding that knowledge beyond what we know into a great amount of unknown. And it gets scary really quick. So I'm glad you dropped that in there and bring up, you know, something like bacteria, viruses, because there could be something that, you know, completely destroys us. And our immunity is built off of what we know, right? Like I said, we're not great at adapting to stuff. So you talk about a manned mission of, you know, a bunch of people. Let's say a virus comes in and kills everybody. Like, well, that kind of sucks, right? We just have to hope that, you know, two survive and that they carry that resiliency on. But that's kind of a scary thought.
What are your thoughts, Lou?
Well, I mean, I definitely agree that we have to be careful. I don't know. I think I'm more afraid of what bacteria are there than the bacteria we're going to bring with us.
Well, let me say this then, Lou. So what if we bring a bacteria and let's say just someone had, you know, just benign, like smallpox, like bacteria or something, like, you know, whatever they bring with them, some disease that we have adapted to here on Earth. And let's say that the bacteria that we introduce that to is hyperactive and really great at adapting to whatever it sees. And let's say that it becomes super resilient to that and then finds another way to attack us. I mean, like, there are ways that, let's say something dormant, we could awaken something, right? Like, oh, this is so sci-fi movie. I kind of like want to write it down like as a script, right? But that we could awaken something by offsetting the balance with what we bring to it, right? We're disrupting something's environment just by us stepping on it. And that could provoke something else.
Well, and that's why I said, you know, I mean, I'm more afraid of what's there, because in a perfect world, there would be nothing there. We would bring what we have with us, and we already know what we're dealing with. We have medicines that fight and combat and, you know, work around that. I mean, I'm in no way saying we've solved everything medically, but we have an understanding of that, and we would be able to make heads and tails of that. But I understand that's probably unrealistic, and so that's why I'm a little more scared of what's there already. Because if we are bringing something with us and there's already something there, either one, it's something totally new, it, like you're saying, Adam, it, something we have reacts with that. I mean, it's just all the bad scenarios I can just start to think.
Makes you really appreciate Dr. Hank McCoy. Wait, was that his name? Or am I mixing up X-Men with Star Trek?
I don't know. Did you say McCoy?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's Star Trek.
Wait.
Is it?
Is Hank
Oh, boy.
Okay. No, I know. Like, I'm upsetting a bunch of people right now. Okay, I keep talking about something. I have to look this up now.
Hank McCoy, you said? That's Beast.
Yep. So...
Whoops.
Damn it, Jim. I'm a podcaster, not a Star Trek nerd.
Whoops. So anyway, back to
Leonard McCoy. Okay. It's Dr. Leonard McCoy from Star Trek.
Oops.
Makes you really appreciate Dr. Leonard McCoy. Forget everything I just said about X-Men confusing that with Star Trek.
So if you're going to send us feedback, we already know it.
Just tweet at me, please. Just go ahead. It's fine. Same last name, you know, like, they're probably related.
Likely. They're both nerds. So, yeah, another thing that I kind of thought of that I mentioned a little bit earlier was atrophy. And I don't know if you two know, which you probably do, but a lot of astronauts, when they're in space for a long period of time, the fluids inside their body actually kind of go into an equilibrium throughout their whole body. And so that's why they have like rounder faces, or, you know, whatever, their fluids have just kind of moved around in their body, because it's not being, there's not pressure on their bodies anymore. So it's almost like kind of like a bloating, but they're not bloating. And so there was a gentleman named Scott Kelly who has a twin. And so they sent Scott into space for a really long time, to kind of start studying the effects of long-term duration in space. And so we won't really know the long-term effects, obviously, until the long-term, but, you know, we're starting to learn some short-term effects and stuff of what that is. I don't know if you guys got a chance to take a look, but he actually wrote a book called Endurance about his time in space. And so what are you guys' thoughts on that? What do you think might be going on with the human body if you're in space for a long duration of time, or even your mind?
Well, I know there are two things that I think you have to divide this in, and that's just the fact that we are social creatures, and that if you're one of the first people to go, it's probably not going to be very social. So that's, I think, could lend some, you know, really hardships on those people. It's essentially solitary confinement. I mean, that's what's rough. It's going to be definitely hard on those people. And then from the physical perspective, I mean, we have studied this a little bit. I mean, I think, you know, for right now, most humans haven't been off the earth for any more than, I think, like up to about a year. And I don't know that 100%. I could definitely look that up and find that in follow up, but there's not a whole lot of, you know, time we've had more than that, I don't think, for any one human to be off Earth. But, you know, anytime you're under less gravity than Earth is, your body tends to weaken, and so, you know, you often see just even the astronauts in the International Space Station, they have to like constantly work out to maintain their like muscles, and so that they don't degrade you know, the muscles that they had. And I think that's totally going to be a thing, is that essentially we could go to another celestial body and inhabit it. And if we stayed for a very, very long time, we because gravity's different, we may adapt, and that'll just be that. I mean, we'll evolve, you know. But the problem we start to face is if we were to ever want to come back to Earth, we would face some really, really big problems. And that's just because the gravity changes. So I think either way, there's a lot of physical issues that could come up.
Absolutely. I think there would definitely be some physiological stuff that would be going on. Just in terms of strength, and I could only imagine what it would do to your bones as well. I mean, calcium, you know, I feel like you wouldn't be producing as much calcium, so your bones would be a lot weaker. I don't know. I just feel like there would be a lot of negative effects on that if you weren't to take care of it.
Yeah. So, I've seen like snippets of things, and I was aware of the twin study that they're running with the astronaut and his twin brother. And you're right. Like the body does change when it's not subject to gravity because nothing's holding it down. Jim, you mentioned, you know, some of the other things with all the fluid inside and digestion and other things that kind of rely on those things, how they change and how it's different in a zero G environment. And to Lou's point, like even on a different, you know, gravitational environment, right? Like when we move to another planet, the moon has less gravity, Mars has less gravity, right? We're talking about changes that could massively affect us. So unless we have some form of, you know, artificial gravity, then we're going to have to find a way to easily adapt to the new environment. And that's going to take a while. And it may be something that you have to gradually like kind of build up to in the sense of like, let's say you have artificial gravity and you start, you know, ticking it down a little bit or ticking it up a little bit, depending on where you are. I think those are all challenges that are going to have to be solved, but it might be easiest to supplement like, or try to recreate the environment we have rather than relying on us to try to adapt to the environment that we're putting ourselves into. It also just reminds me of, Jim, did you ever watch like Dragon Ball Z, like the anime?
Yeah.
You remember when Goku's on route to planet Namek and he's in that Capsule Corp spaceship and he just keeps cranking up their artificial gravity?
Yep.
Yep. That's kind of what I think of, right? Like, all right, like that was a way for him to be in a spaceship with artificial gravity, right? Just like cranking it up to wherever he was going and just try to adapt to that environment. So when he stepped on whatever planet it was, he was that much stronger because he had worked with, you know, in 10 times Earth gravity for the longest time or whatever it was. So.
Well, I mean, which makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, our bodies have been, you know, if you're into this sort of thing, which I am, has been going through evolution for millions of years. And this is what the human body has adapted to over that amount of time. And if you just go somewhere and decide to change everything, then your body's going to react in a negative way because that's not how it was designed.
I'm waiting for that, you know, late night ad to come on. It's like, are you moving to, you know, X planet, whatever it is? So are you worried about not being able to adapt a new environment? For 3 easy payments of $599.95, we'll send you a supplement. Look at the results. He's like, and it has like that, you know, the 1 week, 2 week, 3 week results, you know?
Yeah, for real.
Adapt to any environment. Take this supplement. Call now. Offer ends in the next 30 minutes.
It'll be on QVC. Don't worry.
You can catch reruns. The home shopping network, right?
Yep.
Limited time offer. We only supplies are limited. We'll not last. Uh huh.
Mm hmm. Any final thoughts on space colonization?
No, man. I think we did a decent job of kind of summarizing that, and obviously, it pushes our brains in a different way than I think some of the. Episodes we've recorded have, in the sense that it is really stretching into the future quite a ways away, and so it really makes us have to kind of get into hypotheticals, but I think it's fun, and I think we did it a decent job.
I like talking about it because it just gets to, I get to draw inspiration from all of the sci-fi movies that I've seen, and that's always a good time, you know?
Oh yeah. Sci-fi for the win.
Always.
Well, boys, let's wrap this episode up. So you two are going to be traveling, but that doesn't mean any change in schedules for our listeners, but what are you two up to?
Yeah, where are you going, Lou?
I am doing a Vegas trip.
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot.
With the boys. So, little Vegas trip. I actually haven't been to Vegas. I really should rephrase that. I haven't been to Vegas much over 21, so which is surprisingly because I'm not exactly just over 21. So I was in Vegas for a day over 21, and it didn't. It really wasn't like to do Vegas. It was you know just because we were passing through. So I'm actually excited about this. It'll be fun. Be able to actually like gamble, hang out, watch football. You know, do all the normal Vegas stuff. Eat food. We have some plans to go to a nice restaurant one night. So it'll be good. It'll be good. Where are you going, Adam?
I'm going to San Diego. I'm gonna go back to my stomping grounds. Spend some time with family for the week. So we kind of have an action-packed week planned, right? So we're going to drive down and I have to check up on like the rental house that we have. We want to go see that, make sure everything's good there, see if we can meet the tenants, everything there, because we haven't been down since the new tenants moved in. And we're going to go to Disneyland for a couple days with my mom and my sister. And then we're going to go to SeaWorld. We're going to go do some kayaking. I'm going to be down there at Pizza Port one of the nights. So Jim, you should definitely try to make it out for that. You as well, Lou. So get some pizza and beer in you.
I will be there.
There you go.
I will be there.
And then just spend Thanksgiving with the family and come back up. And the beauty of, you know, being in California is it doesn't take that long to drive down there. You know, so we'll drive down with the dog and everything and pack up all the kids in a car, drive down with the dog, spend, you know, some time down there and then drive back up and then everyone back to school and back to work. It'll just be a nice little family vacation for us. Just the typical once every year we seem to come down and spend time there. So this is that time.
It's that time of year again.
Adam, I think the plan is to drive straight from Vegas to Pizza Port.
Is that so, with all of you? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Nice.
I'm pretty sure that's how that's going to go down. So we'll see, but that's the tentative plan.
That'll be good. I mean, just one of you drive, the rest of you keep drinking, and then when you all stop, like at least one of you has to stop, and then the other person who is driving can start drinking, and then it'll be a good time. I'm looking forward to kind of seeing old faces because it's been a while since I've been down there and seen everybody.
So, we've all. Adam, do you have an iPhone 10? Are you not on that?
You say we all, and it's just you two. I get to sit back for this one and just imagine what it would be like.
So, Lou, how are you liking your iPhone 10, man?
Man, I like it a lot. I think it's a solid phone. I am probably most impressed by the battery life of this thing because I thought we were going to take, I mean, I know they said it was going to go up, but it's just kind of mind boggling to me. Doesn't compute. The phone got physically smaller and the battery went up, and that was a really hard thing for my mind to wrap around, but it is better. And I still am just amazed by it day after day.
Yeah. I mean, I keep finding flows that I really like about it, like the home button not being there. Like seeing a home button feels not to say that it's bad or that it's whatever, but if you still have a home button on your phone, I'm not making fun of you, but it feels archaic. Like I'm like, the home button feels old. Like I'm so into not having a home button. Like it's just so nice. And like I was so excited to finally interact with my phone in gesture-based fashion because it's how I interact with my iPad, and I really like that. So it's just such a nice way to interact with software rather than punching the face of your display with a button. Like I just really like the feel of it.
Well, it's funny too because you could see the death of the home button kind of coming, you know, from the time that they moved it from an actual physical moving button to just being like a little divot in the screen that just kind of like tricked you into being a button. And now that it's gone, you know, everyone I've talked to that has one, they've said that's that's the thing that takes the most getting used to, but it's also the thing that they like the most about it is, oh, you know, some things seem to take longer, but everyone keeps finding like ways to just smooth out the workflow and adapt to being that. Like people say that the fast app switching is like their favorite thing about it. Like it's so much easier, you know, just to swipe between what apps you have open rather than to double click and feel this button and then, you know, do that, or to try to do like a 3D touch gesture from the edge of the screen. And, you know, tons of Android people are probably making fun of us. They're like, yeah, man, like, what are you guys doing with like buttons and not using gestures and stuff? But there's just, you know, the same polish that Apple gives to everything from what I've heard and what you guys have told me too, is just everything just feels right. They make it feel like it should.
The Face ID is super clean.
Hasn't like you covered your eyes and put a scarf on, you know, and like grown out a really grizzly beard and it still recognizes you?
Well, I mean, it just really made me think of what you said about it just feels polished, right? And so I did my Face ID without my glasses and without my hair. I have really long hair, so I put my hair down, but I usually put it up. And so this, when I did the Face ID, I put my hair down and I had my glasses off. And so, excuse me, after I set it up, I put my glasses on and I even put a hat on with my hair up underneath it, and it still recognized me, which I was super impressed with.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy that way. I have to say the, at least the couple times that I've had to kind of demo it for somebody, because they're like, oh yeah, you got the new phone. What is it like? You know, it's, I have shown it to them using I have that setting for attention aware still on. So basically my eyes have to be open for the phone to unlock. So I will close my eyes. I'll hold the phone in front of me. I will click it on and it won't unlock. And then as soon as I open my eyes, the phone unlocks and they are like, whoa, it's mind blowing to them.
So here's like the ultimate test for Face ID, and it kind of goes along with our topic today, is they should set up a Face ID on an iPhone 10 for the astronaut before he goes up into space, leave him up in space for a year, and when he comes back down, see if it still recognizes him. Nah? Nah? No? It will. It's not that much of a difference, but...
But he'll have to enter his passcode because it'll been too long.
Well, yeah, maybe there will be a special like research version of of the operating system that Apple can provide for this study.
Well, all right, boys.
All right, boys. Gentlemen.
Kids.
Nope. Nope, that's not the one.
I'm pretty sure they're not budging on that front, but, you know, that's a topic for another day.
I'm going to cut that out of the show totally.
Can you go tab, then option 8? Nope. Oh, there you go. All right, now you should be able to, like, return, and it'll, like, make another one, maybe?